This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we will hear from Public Affairs Research Council President Robert Travis Scott, who was a journalist covering the Capitol for many years for the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. Robert Travis Scott on the second week of the special legislative session to address the looming fiscal cliff on the 1st of July. Yesterday was a rocky day at the Capitol. Brad Meltzer, the political thriller novelist, television show creator, and comic book author on his latest work, I Am Harriet Tubman, and author Howard Blum on his investigation into the Russian spies during the Cold War. Howard was slated to be with us yesterday, but agreed to come back today. And this Russian spy story is certainly relevant in today's climate with the investigation continuing from Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Locally, 297-5633 if you'd like to dial a few less digits. And you can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Robert Travis Scott is with us. For 8 years, he was the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. And for the last 7 years, he's been president of the Public Affairs Research Council, one of the fine watchdog groups in Louisiana. And he's been watching the goings-on at the Capitol. If you picked up your morning paper today, The Advocate has a story above the fold, House tax talks grind to a halt. Members won't reconvene until Tuesday. Is this a cooling off day, Robert Travis Scott?
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you, Jim. Yeah, it ground to a halt just after getting launched back into operation, Day to day, we're watching to see what the latest impasse is going to be. Basically, they're having a discussion over replacing revenue that will drop off when the temporary fifth penny, so to speak, that 5% sales tax drops to 4% at the end of June. And I think everybody agrees that some of that revenue needs to be made up. The question is how much and how, and that's what they're debating.
It looked a few days ago like they were on the road to some sort of a consensus, and then the speaker and the governor started taking shots at each other, and that's usually not a prescription for success.
Well, I don't know. In a democratic society, you don't expect everybody to do it to agree, and that's what the process is all about. I think what's really happened here is the Black Caucus has stood up and said, we don't want more sales tax. They look at the sales tax as something that places a greater burden on lower income people than the income tax, which is true broadly speaking. So what they're trying to do is say the replacement revenue should be more based on income tax increases, whereas others are saying let's base it a little bit more on the sales tax. At the end of the day, you're going to have some mixture of both of those.
Well, the governor on his show last week, just 6 days ago, said he didn't like sales taxes, but he had to accept compromise to get something done. It takes 70 votes. He's only got 41 Democrats in the House, and if the Black Caucus deserts him, then he has very little base to work with. So what are his options?
Yeah, when the session started out, I think the lead story in The Advocate was, can we get a deal? And if we get a deal, can Taylor Barra, the House Speaker, bring the votes? He can maybe make a compromise with the governor, but can he get the votes lined up behind him? And I remember talking to the reporter back about that and saying, you know, the governor has to bring his votes too. And I think that's what we're seeing right now is he's got to figure out how to bring his side of the votes along as well.
877-217-5757. We're talking about $1 billion. It is amazing that one penny can raise that amount of money, but that shows that consumer activity drives the economy and it drives the state budget. And some would say, look, just renew the penny and quit this nonsense and move on down the road. But you're saying that particularly among the Black Caucus, there is no consensus at all to doing that.
Well, I think there is a middle ground out there. And the other factor that's playing into this, Jim, is that when the Congress changed the federal tax law, that has a big impact on mm-hmm. income taxes in Louisiana. We can deduct the federal taxes that we pay. But the real impact is on the excess itemized deductions. I don't want to drive your listeners crazy here if they don't really understand what that means, but a lot of people, about almost 25% of filers in Louisiana, will go on their federal form and they'll say, hey, here's my mortgage interest, here's right. my property tax, and they'll write all that off. And whatever their excess is beyond the standard deduction, they can deduct from their state income tax. Well, this federal tax reform changed the whole picture of that. You're not going to get as many excess itemized deductions, and it's probably going to be about in the neighborhood of a $300 million hit on added revenue. That's if the state legislature does nothing at all, and they just allow all of that to take place. And if you're someone who files excess itemized deductions and takes that deduction, the average hit for you is going to be about $500 additional state taxes.
So how does this affect the state budget?
Well, all of these things affect the state budget. What we've had in place in the past year is a revenue level that has been about what the legislature has compromised to spend. We had years and years of great shortfalls because we were spending on resources in one year that we didn't have in future years. We kind of stabilized mm-hmm. once we put the penny in, and now we're going back into a period of potential instability if a lot of that revenue isn't replaced.
Well, the governor initially proposed income tax bracket changes as part of his special session plan, but the House Speaker, Taylor Barra, said several weeks ago that it was a non-starter for the conservative-leaning House. So with that as the backdrop, the options are limited, and right now there is a scramble to try to patch a hole here. And the governor on his show 6 days ago seemed relatively optimistic. And now with the session kind of at the midway point, the special legislative session, what are the odds that we're going to hit the finish line with success?
I think they'll arrive somewhere. And they'll arrive somewhere. And the question will really be, I think, at the end of the day, $100-$150 million dispute and not a billion-dollar dispute.
And that could be addressed after the session if necessary.
Well,
after the regular session.
Well, you have to remember, in the regular session, that's when they do the appropriations bill. And they will now go into the session, the regular session, mm-hmm. figuring out how much they can spend based on whatever revenue measures they take in this special session. They'll also take into consideration the impact from the federal tax changes on our tax revenue, and the revenue estimating conference will come in, and they will, you know, pose a new mm-hmm. estimate for our income. And based on those things and maybe some other factors, they will figure out how far ahead or how far behind they are in spending how much they want to spend.
Potentially, this could be resolved then without another special session
yes,
after
it could.
The regular session.
It could be, yes.
I mm-hmm. think everybody would appreciate, including the governor and the legislature. Yeah. But we have a ways to go and not a whole lot of time to get there. It is amazing that this has been looming for a couple of years and it's still hanging out there.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that I would warn people to look out for. Some of these changes that people are proposing for the individual income tax, when you look at some of the tax reform proposals mm-hmm. that were made, the idea was to maybe get rid of some deductions and exemptions in the income tax, mm-hmm. which would imply more revenue would come in, but then you would lower the rates. And that was the idea of tax reform, was to have lower rates and more competitive rates to have a broader base. That was the point. Now, what we're doing now is, and what we've been doing in increments in the past, is we've been finding those things that we could take away in the way of exemptions or deductions. And in this case, we're looking at the excess itemized deductions and expanding the impact of that. But we're not lowering the rates. So you're not really getting that reform. We're sort of doing part one of the reform, but not part two of the reform.
877-217-5757. If you'd like to talk to Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council, great organization. We remember our old friend Jim Brandt, who was in charge for about a decade, I believe, at Parr, and Robert has taken the helm and is watching with earnest what's going on at the Capitol. And it was 10 years ago that the Stelly plan was dumped, and a listener notes that what is going on now is a residual effect of that action a decade ago. Is that fair?
The Stelly plan, which was implemented in the early 2000s, was peeled back in two pieces under Governor Blanco and under Bobby Jindal. What they did is they basically end up rolling back the amount of revenue that we get from the income tax. And that, yes, there's no question that and many other things have had an impact since that time on our whole budget scene.
Question for you, Robert. What is this from Scott in Baton Rouge? What is your estimate of the total tax credits that the state of Louisiana doles out to businesses each year, including the business inventory tax credit?
Yeah, you'd have to just walk through all of them. You've got the film tax credits, which I think we've capped now at $180 million. We have the inventory tax credits, which I think now are in the neighborhood of $200 to $300 million. You have the quality jobs, which is a rebate, not really a credit, and they're trimming that back on a more permanent basis in this legislative session in order to save money. And you're talking about that's in the tens of millions of dollars. I could keep walking through. There's a lot of different credits. That's one of the problems we have in our system is I'd rather have fewer exemptions and credits and lower rates and a broader base.
We'll go to the phone lines with Robert Travis Scott, who will be with us for another segment. Your number again is 877-217-5757. In Baton Rouge, you can dial 297-5633. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. And Sasha Kabalshaw is producing. We're back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana. Robert Travis Scott is with us, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council. Dan Downtown. Good morning, Dan. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Dan.
Dr. Scott, is what transpires in the legislature today indicative that the new golden rule is that who's got the gold, like big oil, gets to make the rules?
Well, and we shall see, because this is interesting. The Black Caucus has stood up and said, we aren't going to go along with a primary revenue raiser based on the sales tax, and we want to see some compromise. And so I think we're about to see your question partially answered. But I would also say that there's a lot of influences in the legislature beyond what you just mentioned.
Well, Foster Campbell once said that the Texaco flag should fly from the top of the state capitol. Big oil does have a big impact at the capitol, and it is a big part of our state's economy.
Well, when I've been out on the capitol, I've seen a lot of influences from a lot of sides, and I sometimes think it's really easy to point at the big corporations and say, you know, they're behind everything and running everything, but I think you'd find a lot of influences in a lot of areas in the
But getting back capital. To Scott, the other Scott's comments, if we got away with some of these, got rid of some of these business tax exemptions, we wouldn't have to go through all these machinations to get a budget done.
Well, you're always going to have tight budgets because the legislature, and this goes for Republicans and Democrats, they always want to spend more than they have. I think what you've seen over time, Jim, is this idea that they're going to end up at the end really arguing over $100 or $150 million. It seems to happen almost every year in every budget cycle. And the Republicans, and this is just a small part of the overall amount of spending and revenue that the state has. The Republican narrative tends to be, we're looking out for the taxpayer, that's what this is all about. The more liberal side says we're looking out for state services. In fact, they both love this narrative. They both like to have this narrative. and but it's they're not as far apart on the actual numbers usually as they both like you to believe.
When we look at what is available, does PAR have some recommendations on how to address this?
We've had a lot of recommendations. One in particular is before the federal tax changes, and especially after the federal tax changes, we would like to see the state sever itself from the federal tax system in the sense of not allowing the federal deduction of the deduction of federal taxes on the state form and getting rid of the tie to the excess itemized deduction. In return for that, which would imply a lot more revenue, we'd like to see lower rates. What you end up with is a much lower rate, more competitive rate, a lot more stability in predicting where the individual income tax revenue is going to come from year to year, just a more stable overall environment and a good growth environment and a good competitive environment. That's where we need to be. We're moving further and further away from that goal.
877-217-5757, a bit more time with Robert Travis Scott. Now, a legislative session of all kinds looms on the 12th day of March, and in that one there will be proposals all over the place, and any chance that we'll have any consideration of tightening of gun laws in Louisiana?
You know, there'll probably be a lot of discussion about it, especially after the Florida shooting. We're a very conservative state when it comes to protecting the Second Amendment. I will tell you one thing that I think is coming up in this regular session that is kind of a sleeper bill, which can be very significant, and maybe some other time I could come on and talk about it in more depth, but there's a bill to reform the state retirement system for rank-and-file employees. It is being supported by a conservative state senator who's head of the Senate Retirement Committee and is being supported by LASERS, which is the public employee, the state employee's retirement system. As far as we know at this point, the governor hasn't weighed in on a final whether he's yes or no on it, but so far he's allowed it to proceed. And this is would reform the system for new employees coming in, and we think in the long run would be better for employees. It would give them something more portable, more worthwhile, and it would also, I think, greatly decrease the proclivity for unfunded accrued liabilities, which is an enormous burden on our state and our fiscal environment right now. So we think this is a very important bill that's coming up in the legislature in the regular session.
Are retirement benefits still based for the state employees based on the top 3 years of earnings? Is that how it works?
Either the top three or the top five, depending on when you were first hired. And there's a formula that we do. Jim, when you look at the teacher system and when you look at the LASER system for state employees, the total amount of operating cost and unfunded accrued liability payments that we're making this year alone is going to be well more than $2 billion. That's right. a tremendous amount that has to be borne.
But in the past, we've seen these lawmakers who are making $30,000 or a little more than that a year. They serve 12 years or more, and then they go into state government and get $100,000 jobs, and then their retirement benefits are based on the 3 years or so that they spend earning $100,000.
That's right, and sometimes that has happened. State lawmakers, at a particular period in history, they stopped being eligible for the state retirement system. But those who had been in it a while, you're right, there have been those who have found those sinecures and have taken advantage of the system. But for the most people in the state employee retirement system, they don't stay in that long, and therefore it's not a very good system for them. We need a better system for the modern workforce. For people who are working in government, they need to have something where if they only work for 4 years or so in state government, they aren't completely wiped out with the retirement investment that they put into it. And that's part of what this new plan would do. It would make a better environment, make state employees give them something more portable they can move around. We're taking a serious look at it, and I think it's going to be better for the people involved.
The governor, I think, earns $135,000 a year, and he's well down the list of those compensated by state government. Should anyone in the government earn more than the governor?
Sure. If you have some especially talented people at your universities who are great researchers and whatnot, and I would say we should find ways to make sure we have really great talent in some of those areas.
Okay, well, the governor is the chief executive of the state, though. Maybe we ought to raise the pay of the governor, but there are many people earning more than $135,000 a year in state government.
That's right, and I wouldn't have any real objection to, you know, raising what the governor is making, but I don't know if that's really the point. The question is, there are plenty of people competing for the governor's job, but you want to make sure that if you have a really difficult position to fill, especially if you're trying to get some
I remember you
researchers
you, when
in.
You were an intrepid reporter, you asked Stephen Moray about his compensation, mm-hmm. Which some found to be excessive. No assault on Mr. Moray, but he was head of economic development. He was earning like three times more than the governor was. Is that appropriate?
If the results are there, then yeah, it is. If the results are there and it's worth it, then I think, you know, there are very few people in that category.
Why did you ask him that question?
I probably asked him a lot of questions, and that was probably
one of
them.
As I recall, he's a good man, and he was talented, too, did a lot of good things for the state.
That's right.
He didn't like that question, though.
Probably not. Yeah.
No, but it is hard to understand how some of these people can make $500,000 a year or so.
Very many doing that.
No, but here, for example, the defensive coordinator at LSU football is making over $2 million a year. He's making many times more than the governor of Louisiana.
I'm not going to parry with the head of Tiger Rag over
Dave Aranda.
LSU salaries. I think you know a lot more. You probably know the salary of the LSU coach in 1937. Do you not?
Well, it was under $10,000.
There you go. Okay.
All right.
Enjoy being on always,
Jim. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. We're back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest now is Howard Blum, the author of the New York Times bestsellers The Last Good Night and Dark Invasion, as well as the Edgar Award-winning American Lightning Wanted, The Gold Exodus, Gangland, and The Floor of Heaven. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, former reporter for the New York Times. He was twice nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. And his latest work is In the Enemy's House, the secret saga of the FBI agent and the codebreaker who caught the Russian spies. Certainly a topic that has relevance in contemporary America and around the world, Howard Blum.
That's for sure. When I started out writing this book, it was really just a Cold War spy story. It was the story of a sort of a playboy FBI agent who teams up with an introverted codebreaker. They're working out of a top secret facility called Arlington Hall outside Washington, D.C., a former girls' finishing school. And these two very unlikely friends start cracking the Soviet codes that were sent at the beginnings of the Cold War, and they discover to their total surprise that the Russians have a program to infiltrate Los Alamos and are stealing our atomic secrets. They go off on a spy hunt step by step, very progressively, as if it were a detective story, to track down these spies. And they find out that the secrets have been stolen. They bring people to justice. It ends up with the Rosenbergs being executed. And then today, as I'm writing this story, Vanity Fair is sending me out to look into the Christopher Steele dossier, other aspects of the present investigations, and I see that the past is not past. I'm caught up in not just writing a Cold War spy story, but I'm living through a contemporary spy drama, as we all are, trying to find out how the Russians played fast and loose with our elections. What happened, 70 years ago, is not just past. This is still a covert war that's being fought today.
Howard Blum's book is In the Enemy's House. The Washington Post says wonderfully gripping, cleverly crafted tension. It's gotten rave reviews from many places, and Howard Blum is a veteran writer, and he knows this terrain rather well. We've had the Russians and the United States at each other's sights for a long time, well over half a century since the Second World War. It seems like more The more it changes, the more it stays the same, Howard.
In many ways. I mean, back in the late 1940s, early 1950s, we were caught by surprise. My hero, the FBI agent, Bob Lamphere, doesn't even want to belong to the Soviet espionage squad of the FBI because as many people in the intelligence business thought, well, the Russians were our allies in World War II. Millions of Russians had died fighting the Nazis. What's the point of spying on them? And yet, as he begins this program, as he works reading their actual messages, he realizes, oh my gosh, the U.S. is under attack. So it is today. You know, Christopher Steele goes off and does his dossier. He's looking for opposition research. He's trying to get the goods on Trump. Maybe he'll find financial crimes. Maybe he'll find something like that. He doesn't realize that he's going to uncover a plot, really, to play fast and loose with the American elections. And once again, we're taken by surprise. And this sense of surprise is further exacerbated by now the President of the United States is denying that the Russians were really involved in this spying, that the U.S. was under attack. And it's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's something that should concern all of us as Americans. It's our national security, and we have to be aware of what is going on. And it's too easy to dismiss it all with the charges of witch hunts. You know, during the Cold War, it was the left who was crying witch hunt. Now it's the right. Well, during the Cold War, we had all the evidence. We had the actual cables. Our spy masters could have shared this with the American people, but they chose not to. And I think they're making the same mistake today. The way you put an end to witch hunts is you stab a stake of truth into the heart of the matter, and that's what we need to do today.
Well, tell us about Arlington Hall and Arlington Hall's place in the enemy's house.
Arlington Hall was a girls' finishing school. It was a pampered place for pampered young women. It had stables, swimming pools, hundreds of acres of forests, rolling lawns. And then as World War II starts, the U.S. government buys this school and turns it into an American code-breaking facility. They first work on Japanese and German codes and with great deal of success. And then as the war is ending, a U.S. Army general says, let's look at what the Russians are sending. We've been gathering up their cables. And we're trying to crack these codes, but they're very difficult to crack because the Russians have first encode their messages, then they encrypt them with a second lock, which is a cipher, and then they throw away the key by using a one-time pad. They burn these cipher pads so they can only be used once. So it's basically unbreakable unless the Russians make a mistake. And when Moscow was under threat of siege, the Russians started not using their one-time pads more than once. And we exploit this. We see this. So we're able to strip the cipher away, and then my hero, Meredith Gardner, this genius codebreaker, working with the FBI agent, they're able to get the code away and discover these various code names of Russian spies out there, names like Rest, Antenna, Goose, Liberal. And they have to figure out who these men actually are and what they're doing now and track them down. And that detective story is the heart of the book.
You called Meredith Gardner your hero. How important was Meredith to this process?
Meredith Gardner was a once-in-a-generation genius. He was able to make connections that no one else could. He's able to reassemble the Soviet code book so that we can read these telegrams. The National Security Council is National Security Agency, rather, has put him in his Hall of Fame. He was a genuine American hero. But what's so interesting is he was a very reserved, detached individual. He's able to team up with the FBI agent, Bob Lamphere, who's the complete opposite. He's a jovial womanizer. One of the reasons why Lamphere keeps on going to Arlington Hall at first is because it's filled with, as he calls it, a secret army of women who went working there during the war. And he likes hanging out there amongst these women. He's one of the reasons why perhaps the Me Too movement was something that was too long in coming. But Lamphere keeps on going there, and he's able to convince Gardner to take advantage of his knowledge, and they're able to work together to make this progress and get the codes and then move after the Soviet agents.
Howard, you note that President Eisenhower never knew that a decoded KGB cable, which was the work of Gardner, offered irrefutable proof that Julius Rosenberg ran a ring of Russian spies.
Yes. The Arlington Hall activities were kept as a matter of it was not in the national interest, our spy masters said, to share this knowledge. They let the nation be divided, this partisan divide, whether or not the Rosenbergs were guilty, as we're now seeing, whether or not Carter Page and other people are guilty. The spy masters held on to their knowledge. And back then, it was a remarkably specious argument, because we knew that the Russians knew that we had broken their codes. The Russians had spies within Arlington Hall who were telling them what we were doing. And it seems that our nation's intelligence agencies very often just like to keep secrets because that's their business. That's their capital. And it's doing this country a disservice. It did this country a disservice then. It allowed people like Senator McCarthy to opportunistically exploit what we didn't know, and it's allowing the issue to get clouded again today. I'm saying it's time for a greater transparency. For example, mm-hmm. in the case of Carter Page, he was wiretapped four times by the government, by the FISA court, the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Court, and three Republican judges approved this. Let's see what the evidence is, rather than just calling it fake news.
Well, you used previously classified documents as well as personal notebooks, letters, interviews. It was really a collective process in putting together the enemy's house.
Yes, it was. I had to meet the relatives. Both Meredith Gardner and Bob Lamphere are dead. So I had to spend time with Lamphere's widow, Meredith Gardner's children, who provided the notebooks that he kept during this time, which were fascinating and helped me enrich the story. At the same time, I tell the other side of the story, the Russian side. It's a spy versus spy drama, and Soviet documents have been smuggled out after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Russian spies eager to brag about what they did and also to, I guess, pad their retirement accounts have written very chatty, interesting memoirs of their activities. And all this allowed me to present both sides, to really tell a spy versus spy espionage story that's also true.
Well, congratulations. It is a fascinating book and an important one. In the Enemy's House from Howard Blum. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you soon. And it was on this date 50 years ago that Walter Cronkite of CBS Evening News made his statement that perhaps changed the course of American thoughts on the Vietnam War. Here's Walter Cronkite, February 27th, 1968.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance the military and political analysts are right, in the next few months, we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite.
Yes.
Good night.
Walter Cronkite 50 years ago. Brad Meltzer is next. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sashika Bonchon is producing, and our guest in our final segment is Brad Meltzer. 4 years ago, the New York Times number one best-selling author was frustrated that his three children were looking up to princesses and reality stars, and from his love of history, he knew there were better heroes for his kids. So right there, the Ordinary People Change the World series was born, and the result is one of the most successful children's picture book series in the last decade. And here we are with his latest work, I Am Harriet Tubman. And good morning to you, Brad Meltzer.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Doing well. And Harriet Tubman's been in the news a great deal. At one point, I think President Trump was suggesting that Harriet be on the $20 bill.
Actually, he was suggesting the opposite. He was trying to take her off the $20 bill.
Right.
She had been voted on many years ago, and God knows what's going to happen. But it, you know, just shows that this person, Harriet Tubman, is as vital today as she ever was, still in the news hundreds of years later. And as you said, when we look around, one of the things that happened, we spoke many years ago about when we started this series, and we started with I'm Amelia Earhart and I'm Abraham Lincoln. We did I Am Lucille Ball because I wanted my daughter to have female entertainment heroes who aren't just famous for being thin and pretty. For my son who loves sports, I did I Am Jackie Robinson. My youngest son who loves drawing and coloring, he's a creator, he's creative. I did I Am Jim Henson, the creator of the Muppets. And each of these people is what I think is missing in the world today is just that better sense of values. That's what we've lost. And we saw this amazing thing happen as Trump was elected, and it was that suddenly our books on I Am Rosa Parks, I Am Martin Luther King Jr., I Am George Washington started taking off. And it wasn't a Democrat or Republican thing. It was that parents on both sides were looking at the TV every day and saying, you know, they were tired of showing their kids politicians. What they wanted to show their kids were leaders. And we all know there's a difference between a politician and a leader. And it just made me realize that today, finding a good hero for our kids is more important than ever, and that led me to I Am Harriet Tubman.
Well, Harriet Tubman was born around 1822 in Maryland, forced into slavery. And as a young woman, she heard about how enslaved people were escaping to the North, and she did that using a route called the Underground Railroad. And then, Brad, risking her life, she returned to enslaved territory over and over again, helping many others reach freedom. It is a remarkable story.
Yeah, and we always start the books. You know, my kids are never going to have a relation to slavery. That's just a hard concept. But one of the things we do is we always show you this hero when they were kids. So when Harriet Tubman was a little girl, her father is the one who taught her about the North Star. And, you know, he pointed out to her that it always points north. And that if you follow it, you'll always know you're headed in the right direction. And as you said, she decides to escape, right? She decides to get out of being a slave, wanted to escape. And what I love telling my daughter loves is it was her and her brothers who all decided at once to escape. But her brothers got scared. The brothers went back. It was Harriet Tubman, the young girl, who decided, you know what? I should get out of here. And she goes, escapes. She has a new life. She has a job. She can live her life forever. It's what every slave wants is freedom. And instead, in that moment, she realizes, you know what, there are other people who need help too. I got to go back and help them. And that, to me, is what we need to teach our kids today, is the measure of success isn't what you achieve for yourself, it's what you do for others. And that's exactly what it says in the book. You can, you know, it's like being a bird. You can fly up really high and enjoy the view, or when you get really high up there, you can look back down and you can go and help others to come up and join you. And I need my daughter to learn that lesson. I need my sons to learn that lesson, that we need to look out for each other.
Well, it was about 11 months ago that our president was questioned about Harriet Tubman, and he said, a very, very courageous, very, very courageous, believe me. It appeared that he might not really know the story of Harriet Tubman.
Yeah, you are not the first person to suggest that to me. And I know I actually have a friend who sent our books to the White House. Because, you know, listen, and I have to say, what we do with our heroes these days is we put them on pedestals, we make giant concrete monuments out them, but we reduce them to images. We reduce them, we lose their stories, we lose their lives. And that's the real shame. I mean, one of the things I wrote in the book is that, and again, it's just so important, in every life we face hard decisions. And at those times, you can make the safe choice or the right choice. So would you put yourself at risk to help someone else? Would you stand up to someone mighty to help someone who's weak? To answer those questions, you have to follow your own North Star, your heart, right? Mm-hmm. That's your North Star. And to me, it will always lead you in the right direction. And I wish that our politicians today, whatever side you're on, I know we all roll our eyes, but we're a country that hates each other. We're a country that's playing this game of us versus them. You know, they're wrong and we're right. And we have to realize that the only people who benefit when we fight like that are the people in power. and that's the only ones who benefit. What we need to do is take that lesson of Harriet Tubman and look out for each other more. That's how you make the world a better place. And it's so funny that I'm teaching these, I write these books for kids, right? They're for young kids, but I sell them more to adults who just want those values back again.
Well, the book is I Am Harriet Tubman from Brad Meltzer. OrdinaryPeopleChangeTheWorld.com is where you can find out more about what Brad has done in this series. And he is a prolific writer of all kinds. And Harriet Tubman is worthy of Americans learning as much as possible about her remarkable and amazing life. And what is the latest regarding the $20 bill?
Yeah, so Mnuchin, the head of the Treasury Department, said he's going to revisit that issue on whether he's going to take her off the $20 bill or not. And no one really knows. They don't know if that was just something that they were saying because they wanted to undo what Obama did when he said we're going to put her on the $20 bill, if that was just, you know, people being mad. No one knows the real answer. And, you know, we obviously kept that detail in the book because we felt like the decision had been made. If they want to undo it, that's, you know, certainly their right to go undo it. I would obviously love to see her on the $20 bill. I'd love to see her honored that way. I think what she stands for is incredible. And for me, other than that, as for what's next, I'm working on the new thriller that comes out next week. And so I love that I get to spend my days, you know, murdering people in my thrillers, and then I get to write books about for kids. And so it, you know, it gets to use two parts of my brain. But The Escape Artist is the new book, and that actually comes out next week. So I'm excited to share that one, the new thriller.
Well, in this day, with the presidency of Donald Trump, former reality star, billionaire tycoon who consorts with porn stars and Playboy playmates, in this case, truth is often stranger than fiction, isn't it?
It really is. In fact, one of the things, I'd love to jump into this. This is great. Is when I was researching The Escape Artist, I started researching 3 years ago. I was on a USO trip. And if you want to know where real heroes are, certainly in our military, and they bring half a dozen thriller writers every year to go entertain the troops. And so that's what I did. Went to entertain our troops, was thrilled to do it. And when I was there, I heard of something called Dover Air Force Base. Now, I didn't truthfully know much about Dover. And it wasn't until I came back that I found out that Dover is where we put to rest the members of the military who not just are regular members of the military, of course, are there, but also our top secret spies, people who are on missions no one knows about in the CIA. It's where, after 9/11, the Pentagon victims were brought. It's where, when the space shuttle went down and the victims of the USS Cole bombing happened, that's where they went to. They all went to Dover, and they gave me unprecedented access to go in. They wanted to teach me about the heroes that no one knows about. And it is an incredible place. I don't want to ruin it, but what I got to see there, I started writing a book about. And I was like, I want to write a book about the men and women who are putting to rest our greatest spies, our greatest secret mission people. And they know secrets more than anyone. It's a building full of secrets. How could I not set a thriller there? And what happened in the past year is Donald Trump shut it down. No one else can get in. And I was, you know, for me, I was like, this is an amazing place that people need to know about. Mm-hmm. This is where we see the consequence of all our actions. Here's where we put to rest the greatest among us, and the decision was made to shut it down, which is a shame. But you'll see The Escape Artist opens with a woman named Nola, who the government says is dead, and they say she died in a plane crash. But when our hero Zig is putting to rest the body, he sees that there's a note inside Nola's body, and the note says, "Nola, you were right. Keep running." And he realizes she's not dead at all. She's on the run. She's the escape artist, and that's chapter one of the book. But it takes you into see this world that, you know, thanks to Trump, no one can really see anymore.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Brad Meltzer, who is probably the most versatile writer in the world today, you managed to juggle a lot of responsibilities.
You know what? I think a good story is a good story, and I appreciate you helping us promote, whether it's the kids' books to give kids better values, which we need so desperately when we look at our politicians today, or when we're looking at the real heroes that we all need, whether it's at Dover and The Escape Artist or anywhere else. I appreciate that you let us play on both sides of that fence. It means more than you realize.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Brad. His latest work is I Am Harriet Tubman, and this is part of a series with over 2 million copies of these books sold now. And it's about Harriet Tubman's brave heroism as part of the movement to abolish slavery. As one of the key players in the Underground Railroad, she helped enslaved African Americans escape and find freedom. And congratulations on your continuing success. You can go to peoplechangetheworld.com to find out more about the remarkable Brad Meltzer. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, sir.
And we're back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Sasha Gabalshaw, I'm Jim Engster. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.